a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Where's Appleberry now? We found him.
I'm here.
What's up, Darren?
Not too bad. Just chilling out. The weather's great in the UK. It's been really good, actually, the last couple of weeks. A bit too hot. So I've been fishing a lot the last 2 months, 3 months, but not so much the past week, just because the weather's we're having like the hottest summer ever, really, I think.
Some of those carp, man, that you're catching, those things look like small hippos.
Yeah, well, I think obviously the Americans don't really get the carp fishing because obviously you don't eat them. Obviously, you're into your predator fishing, which is okay. It's not such a big thing in the UK. I mean, we have pike and eels and that. They taste okay, but the only places you can find bass and trout over here really is like rivers and the ocean. So. Yeah, carp angling is very big in the UK. It's a big, it's an unbelievable market. There's hundreds of thousands of people do it. They have like specially designed lakes with just carp in them. So it's like very expensive. It's really good. Just everything really. It's just a really big sport over here, and it's quite expensive. But it's a very expensive hobby. But the good thing with carp is that they all look different. So you never know what you're going to catch. There's some lakes where there's some monsters in there. So there's a lot of lakes where the fish have names because obviously they're like quite famous. Because a lot of fish, they live till like they're 40, 50 years old. So when you catch them a few times, every fish looks different. So obviously it gets recognised and people give it names. So it's just really fun, really relaxing, and just the buzz, the rod just ripping off. So obviously if you go fishing for sport in America, it's the same thing when you catch a big bass.
So this is this definitely seems to be the trend of the pool players these days. I don't think Shane has gotten off the lake since March. Jason, I don't think we could barely keep him inside long enough to play the Queued Up Cup when we had him. I mean, so here's a fun question. Who do you think, if you added up, if you took the average of their fishing game and their Fargo rate, or just their playing ability, who do you think is the best all-around fishing pool player in the world?
Oh, that's definitely me. Yeah, because like with carp fishing, it's a very skilled. It's very skilled. It's very hard to explain, so I'm not really going to go into it. But there's a lot what goes into it. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot of tactics to it. Blah blah blah. It's very hard to catch the fish, especially the big ones. So you have to be really skilled, really. So like the more you fish, the more you learn. Where obviously Shane goes out in a boat, I'm not too sure how difficult that is. Ice fishing, for me personally, I don't really get it, and never tried it, so I can't really judge it too much. But it just seems to me that it's a bit weird, really. Not knocking him, if he loves doing it, then great. There's a lot of people that love doing it. It's like people don't get me fishing for carp, so but yeah, I mean, I've been fishing my whole life, so I'm pretty decent at it. Carp fishing's a bit different. I've only been doing that a good few years, so still learning, really. But I've got to a stage where I'm sort of ready to fish for like the really known fish, what's really difficult to catch. So that's my next goal. So it's just really relaxing. It's not like something I'm desperate to do, like catch fish. I mean, it's just getting out there, really, and just taking your mind off things, the nature. I love all that, and yeah, just letting the world pass by, just get away from all the craziness. Obviously it's really crazy time, so it's been nice just to get away from everything, and social media and everything else, TV and the news, really. It's been quite depressing, hasn't it? So it's been good. Yeah. Like just to get out there and just just refocus the mind, really.
Yeah. So the honorable mention goes to Shane. Any other honorable mentions?
Yeah, Jason obviously likes his fishing and golf, doesn't he? And I think there's a few guys like Scott Frost. Apparently, is a really good fisherman. I haven't seen him fish, but he looks like he knows what he's doing. John Brumback looks like he's a really good fisherman. He loves his fishing. So there's quite a few pool pool of players who like fishing, and they're obviously into their golf as well. So,
yeah,
it sort of goes hand in hand, I think, because we have a lot of time on our hands when we're not playing pool. So it's like, yeah, it's just nice to get outdoors, isn't it, instead of being stuck inside all the time. And I think that's the big catch, really, is that we spend that much time indoors playing pool. So when we do get the chance to go outside, then obviously we like fishing and golf.
Yeah. Okay. So while fishing is obviously fun and chatting about fishing is always a good time, we're here to talk some pool. So why don't we start with some pool conversation? You have been, well, let's go all the way back to the beginning. Tell us how you got involved in pool and maybe a couple of your early on influences that really helped you grow as a player.
Obviously, pool in the UK is different. English 8 ball, which you see on the small tables, the reds and yellows, obviously you've been over here, so you know where it is. But for people that don't, it's like 7 reds, 7 yellows. The balls are a lot smaller than American pool balls. So obviously the main games over here is obviously snooker's the number one game, and then English 8 ball. Wherever you go in the pubs, bars, all that stuff, you'll see one of them tables. So there's a lot of leagues and stuff like that. So yeah, it's popular, but it's just no real money in English pool. But anyhow, my cousin, when I was around 10 years old, my cousin Andy Appleton, he's like maybe about 7 or 8 years old, probably like 10 years older, sorry. So at the time, he was like in his early 20s, and he was one of the best players in the country. So I used to watch it a little bit because it'd be on television maybe once, twice a year. And then I get to see him in a few exhibitions when he was like local to me. So I just sort of picked up the cue there. I thought, oh, this is pretty good. Sort of liked it. But at that time, I was more into soccer, more into boxing. So I played a little bit with my brother Shane, who was a good pool player. Also, he turned professional at English 8 ball. So we just did it as a pastime in the early days. And then when I got to about 15, went to my local pub. Across the road from the boxing gym where I trained with my brother Shane, and we was practicing really, and then the landlord come over and he says, do you want to play in our team, in their league team in Pontefract? So I thought, yeah, let's give it a go. And then as soon as I played that first league match, that was me done. Started playing all the time then, and then my brother got a table. We was never off the table. Then we started to go to the pool rooms like locally, like 10-15 miles away, and then we started entering, and then we entered another league, and then we started playing like local tournaments, and we was doing very well very quickly. So I just got hooked straight away, because I thought, all right, I can make a bit of money doing this, where with soccer and boxing, unless you made it to the top, you couldn't make no money. So by the time I got to 15-16, I sort of knew that this was for me. I was playing snooker as well, but I just didn't love snooker. And at the time, snooker, there was only maybe like 7 or 8 tournaments a year. So it was very difficult to make it in snooker. This was like the early 90s, let's say. So like, if snooker is what it is now, back then, I might have gone down the road of playing snooker, because snooker now is like 25 events a year. Like ranking tournaments a year, so there's loads of opportunities, where back then there just wasn't that. Where pool, it was every week, every day, if you want to play like leagues, county, playing local tournaments. So that's where it all led to. And then at 16, I decided to quit the boxing. 17, sorry, is when I quit boxing. And then I started slowing down with the soccer, because obviously it's easy to get injured. And then I just started playing pool full time from the age of 17. So I started playing it in all the proms, and I just did really well very quickly. I was just very lucky, I guess, just like it just come natural to me. So yeah, I just got into it very quickly, and it just happened very quickly, and just went on from there. So by the time I turned 19 years old, I turned professional.
And this was all in English 8 pool still, right?
English 8 ball, yeah, that's all I played. Played a little bit of snooker, really, just for practice, just to sharpen your game up for English 8 ball, but I was probably a semi-professional level at snooker, but never took it serious really. But pool, I was doing really well. Like the first pro event I ever played in, I won it. So soon, and like the first major amateur event I played in, the National Amateur Championship at 18 years old, I won that as well. The first national junior tournament I played in, I won that as well. So everything just happened very quickly, and then by the time I got to 19, then I knew that I was never going to be working a 9-till-5 job, really.
Yeah. So going to, I guess, what was, you said earlier that there's just not a lot of money in English 8-ball. And yeah, that still is the case today from my understanding of it. Yeah. Was that the catalyst that switched you over to predominantly 9-ball, although you play every game, which we'll talk about in a little bit? 9-ball was so kind of the game at the time that you switched over.
Yeah, I mean, at 19, let's say, from the age of 19 to 20 to like 30 years old, that was my English 8-ball career, really, from like the age of, let's say, 20 to 30. During that time, I probably averaged about $40,000 a year, and I was winning maybe 10 to 20 tournaments a year. And in that time, I was like, I was never outside the top three in the rankings. I was number one for five of them 10 years. If it wasn't number one, I'd be number two or three, and I was making $40,000 a year. So I was sort of dominating along with a guy called McHill. So it was tough, you know what I mean? But obviously, I didn't have to travel to different countries because it's a very UK-based game. We'd only have like a few events abroad, like France or Malta, the odd tournament in South Africa. They're the only countries what really play the game. What happened is that I just thought, well, it's a game where you watch it on TV, you just don't see how it can become any bigger. It just hasn't got anything exciting about it. It's like this. It's just repetitive. You are doing the same thing every rack, and it's like a miniature snooker game, but worse, if you know what I mean. I don't want to slag it off because it is a very skilled game, also. But it just don't look great on the eye. The rules, everything else. And I thought the ownership of the tour at the time, I'm thinking it's okay, but I just can't see how this game is going to go to the next level. We American pool during that period. I always watched the World Championships, and I actually played in a qualifier for the World Championships when it was in Cardiff around 2001, and I qualified, got to the last 64 of the main event, and I beat some good players. I thought, oh, I really like this game, but just didn't think anything of it because it was hard to give up that $40,000 a year to go to a different game. What's really, you've got to go outside you've got to travel to play American pool. It's not really played in the UK. But like there is a tour in the UK, and there was back then, but the money was very small. So I'm thinking, like, it's hard to really give up my status in English 8-ball to switch over to American pool, even though I was watching the Moscone Cup, the World 9-ball Championships, and the World Masters, stuff like that. But it was something I always wanted to do. So what happened then is that 2005, Kevin Trudeau, he started this IPT, the 8-ball tour in America, International Pool Tour, and it was like a multi-million dollar tour playing 8-ball, but obviously on American pool tables. So I thought, read about that, but you had to apply to get on the tour. So I said to Mick Hill, another really great English 8-ball player, I says, we should apply for this, and he's saying, no, it's probably not going to happen, it's like a pipe dream. But I said, yeah, but we should apply just in case. So we both applied, we got accepted because obviously we had good credentials playing 8-ball. We got accepted playing the tour. It was a 200 player field for the tour. So then from end of 2005, that's when I really started playing American pool to get ready for the IPT, which started in 2006. So with the first two events in the IPT was like unbelievable, the best two tournaments I've ever played in. Just unbelievable, like the prize money. I mean, the first event I finished seventh, so I got like $60,000. And then the second event, I finished like 22nd and got like $30,000. I mean, it was crazy in prize money. But sadly, after the IPT, after them two events, the IPT folded. So we was all devastated, really. I'm thinking, what do I do now? Thinking, do I stick with American pool or do I go back to playing English 8-ball full-time? I thought, well, I've built up a little bit of money here. I'm thinking, I've always fancied this American pool, obviously Moscow and all that stuff. And I thought, well, I've got a decent head start because I know the basics. I know how to win, let's say. I got that winner's mentality, so I just had to learn the game and all that stuff and just put the work in. So I decided in end of 2006 just to play American pool. So then I started spending a lot of time in the Philippines, just to learn my trade, really, for the first year, just playing loads of money matches. It was unbelievable, playing money matches after money matches in the Philippines. And I go to America, spend a few months there playing on the road, playing money matches there. So it was great seasoning. I was learning all the time, especially with the Filipinos and even some of the Americans with the different games like One Pocket and Bank Pool. So then, yeah, 2008, I decided, right, let's cut down on the money game scene and really focus on the tournament. So then I just 100% decided that this is for me. I'm going to play American Pool. And then, yeah, that's basically what happened. So the last 12 years, I've been a full-time professional American Pool player.
And in that stretch, so basically the moment that you decided to go full-time 100% into this, you probably... You know, Mika Eminen could make a pretty serious argument as this. Shane Van Boni could make a pretty good argument. But you probably had – you certainly could not make a list without you being on it. Probably yep. one of the best five-year stretches in pool of anybody in history. I mean, you won you won the World 8-Ball, 9-Ball, 10-Ball. You won some straight pool championships. I mean, you won so many things in a five-year stretch. And I want to focus now on that, I guess, five-year stretch before moving on from there. You won just about everything that you could have possibly won. Was there anything in there that you wish you could have won that maybe you came up a little short or maybe you just never had the opportunity to? Is there one title out there that you still wish you had?
Probably the China Open, really, is the only one what really sticks out, just because it's been an annual event for at least 15 years, 20 years maybe, and that's the only one where I didn't really do well in. Never really did well in China. It was weird. It was like maybe the climate, the food, the time zone. But then it all changed when I won the Chinese 8-Ball World Championship in 2015, and that's by far my greatest achievement in pool. And I don't think I've really got the credit for it, really, because it's an hybrid game with English 8-Ball players, American pool players, and all the top snooker players were there. And all the, obviously the Chinese 8-Ball players were like robots. They play it day in, day out. So to win that world championship was just incredible. I mean, it's by far my best achievement. And like you say, from 2008 to 2015, I'd probably say a seven-year stretch. When I look back now, at the time, you just don't realise. You just go with the flow because there's tournament after tournament. You don't really have an off-season. But obviously, especially the last 2 years, 3 years, I've had a lot of time to reflect. So, yeah, I mean, when I look back now from 08 to 2015, it is pretty incredible what I achieved, really, and sort of pinched myself a little bit. So, yeah, I think that seven-year stretch, I think I was probably the most successful player regards winning the biggest majors.
And I think I tend to agree. I mean, I'm looking at the list of your titles now from that stretch.
I won the World Games, which was like, I mean, the World Games, I mean, that's right up there with any World Championship. I mean, that was a dream come true, the World Games in 2013. Even when I won the World Straight Pool, it was a World Straight Pool field, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was a world-class field, and I played unbelievably in the final there against Shane. I won the Champion of Champions twice, even though it's an invitation event with only four players. It's very difficult to get there, but it's winner-take-all. So that was like... So that tournament's the ultimate pressure. That's like playing the last rack in the Moscone Cup, for example. Then obviously all the Moscone Cup success, the World Cup of Pool, the World 9-Ball, World 8-Ball, World 10-Ball.
Masters.
It's just been crazy, really. I've won some of the big tournaments where they probably don't get recognised. But, I mean, obviously, like you said, the straight pool, I won a big tournament in Hungary, a big international 8-Ball event in Spain, all that stuff. So, I mean, yeah, I've won Euro Tours, you know what I mean? It's just been crazy, really. And there's quite a few, I've lost quite a few semi-finals and finals also, you know what I mean? So, I mean, it was an amazing stretch, that seven-year run. The only thing I would say is that the problem with pool for me, Nate, is that we have no real structure and no real tour or ranking. Mm-hmm. So,
and that is definitely something I want to get into in a little bit.
Who was the best player between that time? But if there was a ranking just for the major tournaments, I'm pretty sure I'd be number one for that seven-year stretch, where... If you look at Shane Van Boni's record in America especially, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. He's like the Tiger Woods in America, let's say.
And you're like the Brooks Koepka, who just he only plays in the major events, but
exactly,
he wins them all.
He's like a Nick Faldo or something like that. They just turn up for the big tournaments, and luckily I was that guy, where Shane obviously is unbelievable what he's achieved in America, but he hasn't won as many big titles as me regards the big majors. So there was a big debate whether he should have got the decade player of the year or myself. I mean, but that's other people's opinion, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I think if if my stretch would have been like from 08 to 15, and then but if that was from 2010 to 2018, let's say, then I think I maybe would have got the nod. But obviously Shane's had an amazing career also. So
yep.
And he still hasn't won a world championship, which is incredible, really. I mean, that's how we pull. Pulls are very. It's a very cutthroat game, and there's no guarantees. So when you win a big title, you're always. It's important to enjoy it, because even as good as what you are, you're not guaranteed to win again. You know what I mean? It's just one of those games.
Yeah, for sure.
Imagine Shane Van Boning going through his whole career without winning a world championship. I mean, that just shows how crazy the game is, really.
Yeah, and how tough it is at the top. And I'm looking at yours, and I'm seeing. Is it correct that you've won 5 world titles?
I've won 3 official world titles. The Chinese 8-ball was a WPA tournament at the time. The 9-ball and the 10-ball, and the world straight pull, which is a unofficial title. So I've got 3 official world titles, like world championships, and then I've got the world straight pull. But then you could argue like the world games, the world masters. I mean, they're world titles, but they're not world championships.
The U.S. Yeah. Open isn't exactly what it is now, but even back in 2010 when you won it, I mean, that's while technically it's not a world event, the best player.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
that might
be
the biggest.
Obviously, we'd class it as a major tournament. It's just not a world championship.
I mean,
so it's a bit like golf. You win the Open championship or you win the U.S. Open. Yeah. So
and you won
twice. The U.S. Open's one of the big 4 tournaments to win. You know what I mean? Probably like at that time as well, 2010, 2011. All the players were playing. It was a 256 player field. The venue was incredible. The Convention Center in Chesapeake, by far the best venue we've ever played in. The field, I mean, there was all playing then, like your Alex Pagelani, your Efren Reyes, Ronnie Alcano, your Shane's, Mika. There was all there. So I mean, to win that twice on the bounce there, is probably again like, and it gets lost again because it doesn't say world champion, it says US Open, but at the same time, it's just as good, if not better, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So let's look at this stretch from a different perspective. When you were playing in this, the top players were, I mean, your prime basically overlapped with Shane, and you kind of hinted earlier that maybe you should have got the player of the decade, and I think a lot of players actually agree with that. I don't think that you're off on an island.
It's not a big deal. Yeah. I mean, Mika won it in 2000 and what? 2010, and there's a big question mark there whether it should have been Efren Reyes. For me personally, it was Efren Reyes, but it's just all opinions, you know what I mean? I mean, both unbelievable 10 years, it don't really matter. It's just people's opinion, and people vote whichever way they want to vote. That's okay.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, my main rivals throughout my career, obviously Shane's been my main rival, let's say.
But you also overlapped with Mika Eminen. You overlapped with players like Dennis Arcoyo. Francisco Bustamante was still hitting the ball. Earl was towards the end of his career, but he was still hitting them great, as well as Johnny Archer. Who in your, I guess we'll start this question with, who is one player that you absolutely loved playing against? You felt like you had their number, and it was basically a bye. Maybe not as disrespectful as that makes it sound, but you loved to play against. And what's one player that you hated to play against?
I love playing Shane because obviously the majority of the tournaments were in America, so there's nothing better than beating like the American hero in America. I had the ultimate respect for him. He just brought the best out of me for whatever reason. He just brought the best out of me, so I have a good personal record against him. Probably a better record against him than what anyone else has got. I have a really good record. I just enjoy playing him, you know what I mean? He's just a great challenge. Just enjoy playing against him. Obviously, he's beat me as well in some big events, but I just seem to have that edge on him for whatever reason. And then you've got other players who are not as good as him, who I don't have a great record against. So, and he's probably the same. So it's just the way it goes. I probably enjoy playing Shane the most. He sort of got me. I think he just brings you that. It brings you that extra 5% out of your game when you play someone like Shane. But there's players who play him and they just crumble. Mm-hmm. Top players, you know what I mean? So I just enjoyed the challenge playing him. I didn't feel much pressure playing against him. I just enjoyed it because I really respected him. Then you got the one player who I really disliked playing. I won't say disliked playing, but I thought, this is going to be hard graft. It's going to be hard work. You're going to have to scrape him off the table. And that was Ralph Suke. Just did everything methodically, the same. Every shot, he had the same routine. He very rarely plays the wrong shot, doesn't take any risk. You know what I mean? Everything's calculated. He plays at the same pace, everything else. He just poker face, all that stuff. He's just a really hard person to play against. So you had to play your A game to beat him, where his B game was better than everyone else's. And that's why he's had so much success. Where his A game, he's probably not a top 10 player. But his B game wins him 80% of the tournaments he's won, you know what I mean? And that's a great asset to have, you know what I mean? And so he was tough to beat. And also, so I'll probably say, and then the guy what I thought probably scared me the most when he was on top form was probably Wu Chaoqing.
That guy is crazy. That guy is actually crazy.
Yeah, I'll probably say he's probably the best player I've ever played against.
Okay, and that was going to be my next question, which is perfect.
Yeah, over that 10-year spell, I did play him loads of times, but I'd probably say he's the guy what I thought, I might get blown away here. You know what I mean? It was like, well, one of those you're thinking, if you're not 100%, you might get blown away. Not like get beat 9-6, 9 or 11-7. You might get beat properly. And it happened a couple of times, actually. He like butchered me a couple of times. I'm thinking, like, I don't really know what I've done wrong here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Shane can do that to you, and so can Jason and Dennis Arcullo and Alex Pagliarini. But with Wu, he just had that presence about him. He has that aura about him when he's at the table, where the others didn't quite have that for me. That's no respect to them. It's just everyone's different, and they might look at different players in a different way. But when I play in Wu Chaoqing or when I watch him play, he had like a great presence about him. Probably like Earl Strickland had, like, let's say, 15, 20 years ago, or a Johnny Archer. So, yeah, I'd probably say Wu Chaoqing, probably the most dangerous player I've ever played against. Ralph, probably like the guy that you didn't really look forward to playing. And obviously Shane, I probably enjoyed playing the most, just because obviously he's an amazing player, and you knew that you had to play great to have a chance to beat him.
Yep. So I guess looking around at the European players, especially the youth, which is the direction of this question, there is almost an embarrassment of riches with what you have. Are there any players out there that are maybe under the age of 22, 23, something like that, where you look at that player and be like, that could be the next Darren Appleton, meaning, you know, they could have a 7-run stretch in this game where they might look like the best player who ever even touched a pool cue. Are there any players out there that you see right now where you think that they could be the next, you know, top player?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, obviously, he could be one of them, but Joshua Filler, I mean, he's just, for his age, he's the best player I've ever seen. He's what, you know, I think he's 21, 22, so he falls in that category. What he's done in the last 3 years is incredible. Well, last 2 years especially. I mean, to win the titles, he's won in such a short space of time, and I only see him getting better. I know he's like a love-hate relationship with the fans, but, I mean, you can't not enjoy watching him play, really. He just hits the ball different to everyone else. His timing, his pocketing ability, but also he's getting strong all-round game. He's learning how to play one pocket, bank pull. He plays really good. You know what I mean? He's like, I only see improvement from him, and he's got that ultra confidence. He's got a confidence what I've never seen before in any player, really. Belief and confidence. He reminds me of a guy what played English 8-ball called Gareth Potts. You might have heard of him.
I have, yes.
He sort of lacked in certain departments in the game, like tactically and all that stuff. Maybe didn't have the best patterns, but let's say, but he had so much confidence and belief in himself. But Joshua, I think, he's took that confidence, that belief to a different level. I mean, Shane has it, Jason has it, and guys like that. But Joshua, you just know when he's under severe pressure and that big match situation, he's the one guy that I'd want shooting for me in a big pressure moment. So, and he just makes the game look easy. I mean, the way he hits the ball, whether you like him or not, he just hits the ball so beautiful. It's just timing, just perfection there. So, yeah, I think he's gonna be the guy to beat, I think, for the next 10, 15 years. But, I mean, there's guys coming through also. I mean, Fedor Gorse, like I just mentioned, Clenty Kachi, all them guys, Asian guys like the Young Ko. Maybe his younger brother. There's a few other guys over there coming through, the Asians. So, I mean, even America, I mean, looks like they've got a couple of young players coming through. So, yeah, I mean, the game's in great shape. But I think Phil is the guy, really, for us all to catch right now.
Yeah. So that covers up through about 2015, 2016. And then at that point in time, we see, I don't want to say a falling off, but we don't see any of the top titles anymore. And I've read a big, long post that you have made about this time in your life. And I don't know if you wanted to go into it or chat about it at all, But there is kind of a little bit of a falling off of your career.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, when I won the Chinese 8-Ball World Championship in March of 2015, I sort of hit a brick wall. I thought, yeah, it was like the cherry on top of the cake in my career. So what happened then? For the next 6 months, I just completely lost all motivation to play. I thought, oh, I don't have any goals here. The only goal was to play in the Moscone, but I knew I was in the Moscone Cup as soon as I won that tournament. That time I was still at the top of my game. So, 2016 come, and it was like sort of struggling here to really get any motivation to set any more goals. And then obviously a few things happened. My father had a stroke July 2016. That was pretty bad. And then my mentor died around the same time. So that hit me quite hard. And then at the end of 2016, I sort of got back into the game again, managed to make the Moscone Cup, just sort of grind my way through that, really. Didn't play great, but managed to get points on the board, let's say. And then 2017, that's when it all went pear-shaped. My mother got diagnosed with terminal cancer April. And I was just starting to make a comeback around March of that year. I was doing a lot of drills, doing a lot of practice, and I got my game back. And then my mother got diagnosed with terminal cancer. And obviously at that time I was living in America, I was married. So I come back to England. I was back in England about 6-7 weeks. And I went back to America. And then I broke up with my wife. I don't really want to go into that, a bit personal. But, I mean, that really hit me really hard. So it come at a terrible time in my life. Obviously, my mother getting diagnosed with cancer, they only give her 3 or 4 months to live. So I decided to come back to England. I spent the next 3 months in England, but my mum was defying the odds. So I go back and forth then between America and England, but I couldn't commit to any tournaments because my mother's condition was very fragile. So I'm thinking, well, I don't want to be stuck in China or the Middle East or even America, and something bad happens to my mum and I cannot get back in time. So, and then obviously at this time I was really caring for her. I've become her carer. So, but she kept defying the odds. So that went on for 2 years. I mean, 18 months where she just kept grinding on, like, and doctors said, oh, she probably got a week left to live, and then she recovered from that. And I mean, she had cancer in the throat, so she couldn't eat. I mean, she was living on soup and custard for like 2 years. So, and then obviously I was going through my marriage breakup, so that was crazy. And then obviously going through all that stuff. So I was having to go back and forth just because of that reason. I was trying to be trying to run the World Pool Series at the same time, which was very difficult. Tried to play a few tournaments just to keep the sponsors happy. So my head was all over the place, and that really sent me down into a I mean, obviously at the time people didn't want to speak about the mental health, but I really was struggling around 2018. I think I went into a deep hole with depression, and then I thought about quitting. I actually did quit, really. I just didn't announce anything because I wanted to just think, well, I'm sort of getting paid still to play from my sponsors. I'm thinking, do I just throw all this away? Maybe I might make a decision where it's a bit hasty. But I was having 4 or 5 months where I didn't even pick up my cue. So then end of 2018, I mean, yeah, 2000 end of 2017, I had to get the dogs over to England. So I brought the dogs over. So I sort of settled back in England. But then I was selling my house, all that stuff. I mean, still running the World Pool Series 2018. So then obviously in 2019, my mother passed away in March. And I just got back to America because she was doing okay, really. It was weird. I mean, she wasn't in the best of health, obviously, but I didn't think she'd be like passing away in the next week or so. So I come back to America to play the Expo, and then obviously as soon as I got there, the next day I got the phone call to say that she'd passed away. So I mean, that just it hit me like a brick wall, because I'm like a mummy's boy. She like wiped my ass, really, for 33 years of my life before I moved to America. So, yeah, that was really, really tough, very tough to deal with. Still a bit surreal now, really. But, I mean, in some ways it was a big relief in some ways, because obviously to see her suffer like that was unbelievable. So I sort of relieved for her, really. And then obviously from a selfish point of view, I thought, well, at least I can sort of make a comeback playing pool, because obviously she didn't have any life, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was tough times. And then sort of thought about, what do I do from here? And then I thought, around August 2019, I thought, right, I was watching a lot of pool, obviously not really playing any pool, so I thought, I think I can still I can still give a lot to the game. I think I can still compete at a top level.
Yeah.
And so, I managed to get my own unit in where I live, my own table, which you've seen on the streams and everything. And I've been practicing. I practiced my ass off. I got my game back in November. I sort of had a good run at the International Open, played really well. I lost out to Filler, 11-10. And that gave me the confidence then going into this year. Obviously, my plan was to play all the Moscone Cup tournaments. And for two or three years, I just basically took two or three years off the game. I was less than a part-time player. And obviously, went through a lot of mental issues and personal issues with breakup of the marriage of my mother. And moving back to the UK, it was big. So, yeah, it was a tough time in my life. But now, obviously, I'm focused back on playing pool. And that was my goal, was to get back winning a major tournament this year and get back in the Moscone Cup. But obviously with the current situation, it's not possible.
Yeah. And I think as humans, we really like to see these kind of rise to the top, and then we like to see the fall of the player, and then we like to see the struggle back of the player. I mean, name me a movie in the history of forever that doesn't follow that same exact kind of chronology. And you'll be hard pressed to find them.
People have always been scared to speak up, and everyone goes through tough times, you know what I mean. So obviously, I'm not the only person who wants to go through all this. But when it all happens at the same time, it's like gives you a bit of like brain damage, really.
Yeah,
it's
for
like,
sure.
It's too much for the human brain to deal with, and then social media didn't help. Also, I was spending too much time on there, and it's easy to get. You start to become a bit bitter as well, and then there's a lot of haters in the game. And obviously, there's people that's going to like you, there's people that's going to dislike you, and then people writing you off and thinking, yeah, but you don't really know the story. You know what I mean? You don't know Darren Appleton. You don't know the story of the reasons why. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? We pull especially. We don't get the exposure, the recognition we deserve, so people don't really know what's going on. Yes. Where if it's Tiger Woods or a Roger Federer or someone like that, or even anyone famous, you know the reasons why, because it's always in the news.
Yeah, and we do. We get to see you don't leave your apartment and have, you know, the paparazzi follow you for six blocks,
yeah, exactly.
Right? So yeah. I think... I don't want to say that people forgot about Darren Appleton, but I think they forgot what Darren Appleton could do. And when we saw that stretch from 2006 to 2015, we really saw what a real Darren Appleton can do on the table and how he can strike fear into his opponents. And I think the mystique of that really was lost from 2016 to even to this day, I think. But what people really don't realize, unless they actually follow, maybe they watch a little bit of the Q It Up Cup.
Yeah.
I don't think that this is 2013 or 2014 Darren Appleton or 2010. Yeah. I don't think I don't think that this is that Darren Appleton, but I think the version of your game that I'm seeing right now, that version, that 2006 to 2015 version of Darren Appleton, would be really scared to play against this version of Darren Appleton. Your game is getting back, and it's getting back fast.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened is that I played that money match that 2 months ago against Kurt Weaver, and I practiced unbelievable for that match. And I played, even though it's like ball in hand after the break, I won 29-1 playing 30 racks of nine ball. We play for like $5,000, so there was a bit of pressure there. But I won 29 racks out of 30, so... but just the way I felt at the table, everything else, you just thought, oh, yeah, I'm back. You know what I mean? And then what happened then is that you find out who's in the Moscone Cup, who's potentially going to be in the Moscone Cup, and that sort of hit a brick wall, really. I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do for the next 3 or 4 months? There's going to be no pool tournaments. But like you say, yeah, I think I'm close. I think the good thing is that I've got a better mentality for the game now than what I've ever had, really, a better outlook. Not be as hard on myself, not punish myself when I make mistakes, all that stuff. So yeah, I could be even more dangerous. I just don't know.
Yeah. And did that
we'll
come?
Have to wait out. We'll have to see next year. But I definitely know that I can compete again. That's for sure.
Yeah. Did that come from 2016 to 2019? That this newfound.
Yeah, definitely for sure. Okay. Yeah, different perspective on life when you go through tough times and you got rock bottom. Really, I mean, there were times. Last year, 2018, I just didn't want to get out of bed. Just didn't want to do anything. And you just didn't want to socialise. I wouldn't even want to do something like this. I probably didn't do an interview for 2 years. Where now I sort of like, yeah, of course I'll do it. So I think it's important that people, I mean, obviously if they're going through these problems themselves, it's important to go and get the help. I was one of them. I'm a bit hard-headed, quite selfish, let's say, but you need to be in this industry. And I just didn't really get the help I needed, but I did end up speaking to a lot of people recently, and I did get some help, and it definitely helps. Yeah, it definitely helps to seek help if you're going through problems, and it's easy. That's why a lot of people are suffering now, because the world's gone crazy for a start, and there's so much going on in the human brain. It's like you're trying to do too much at once, and I think we're all guilty of that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I think the idea of being able to ask for help and knowing that you need the help is a very valuable thing for anybody, nonetheless. You know, somebody who has the weight of the world on them.
2 years ago, not seeking help, but when I did at the start of the end of last year, I started to seek some help, and it definitely makes a difference to speak to someone who understands. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. So I think, if you're okay moving on from there, we are kind of seeing where your game's at right now, and do not sleep on Darren Appleton. I mean, I guess we can sleep on everything for the next couple of months, because like you said, this world's gone mad, but given 2021, whenever it is, when things start opening back up again and we're having these big tournaments, where do you see your game at? Do you plan on working your butt off and getting back to the 2012, 2010 version of yourself, or are you just going to play the game for fun and wherever that takes you, it takes you?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, obviously, this last 2 months, and let's say the next couple of months, really, I've just sort of planned on chilling out, getting my head together, doing a lot of fishing, all that stuff. And then November, when obviously it gets closer to next year, and I think we should have a calendar for next year, then I'll be the same as what I was three months ago, just practice every day, do my coaching, which I enjoy. I do a lot of coaching as well from my unit, and obviously when I come to America, I do clinics. So yeah, just keep doing all that stuff. Practice really hard, get my game. Because the good thing now, because I did put the hours in during lockdown, and I got my game to where I want it to be. I know I can get it back there very quickly. So I think maybe like 3 or 4 weeks practice, I'll be back to where I was, let's say, two or three months ago, and I know that version of me can compete and win tournaments. It's not guaranteed, but I can definitely go into matches with people like Filler and Shane and Jason, and know that on my day I can beat them and win tournaments. And that's the key. Obviously, I'm not going to dominate, but I know I can still win big tournaments, and for sure definitely get back in the Moscone Cup. Even more so after. Been a viewer for the last 2 years, a European player. It made me realise that, I think I should be on the team, and I think I have been missed on the team, not just for playing, but also in the changing room, in the dressing room, and all that stuff, on the practice table, getting the players to click. Like when I look back now, I think I was the playing captain, really. Whether the other players want to admit that or not, I don't know. Obviously, everyone's got that bit of ego, but. I think I led the team, I think, and I think they're missing that big time, and I think they're going to miss it again this year, sadly, but end of the day, I'm not in charge of the team, so that's their decision, isn't it? But yeah, I think definitely get back in the Moscone Cup for next year. That's going to be my number one goal, and obviously get back in the match room tournaments like the World Cup of Pool play with Jason Shaw, which obviously if I get to play with him, and it's great prize money, $120,000 to the winner. I think me and Jason together, if we practice together and work hard together, I think we've got a good chance. And then obviously, yeah, just get back in all the major tournaments and obviously try and win one of them. Doesn't matter which one, really. I mean, I'm not thinking, I want to win another world title. I just want to win a major title, whether it's the US Open, International Open, China Open, whatever. Just they're all the same, really. Just win one of those, it sets you up for the rest of the year, and obviously going forward, it gives you that confidence you need then.
Yeah, and so one thing that I don't want to brush over as well, that I think is really important is during this shutdown, you actually have taken it as an opportunity to start building a little bit of a maybe a YouTube or social media presence. So why don't you talk a little bit about the YouTube channel that you created, where people can find it, and what the benefits are of possibly subscribing to you and following you?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, like, I really love coaching. It's not for everyone. There's a lot of people what coach and they don't enjoy it, players especially, and then there's players what do enjoy it and players what don't enjoy it, but they do it because they do it for the money, where I just, it was never my intention. I just like helping amateurs. I'm probably more friendly with amateurs than I am pros. I'm not that friendly with professional pool players. I'm etiquette with them. They're my peers, what have you. I'm friendly enough with them. I mean, there's one or two what I get on really well with. But in general, I don't get too close to pool players, especially professionals, because I don't know. But when it comes to the Moscone Cup or whatever, I'm their best friend for the week. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and that's
sure.
What you got to do. Where we amateurs, they're no danger to me. They look up to me, for example. They ask me for advice. So I'm more than happy to give them it, even if it's for free. And I do a lot of stuff for free. And I like giving the feedback. I like showing people what they're doing wrong. What they can improve on. So, yeah, I just love that aspect of it and helping people. So, yeah, I just love being that leader, that sort of coach type of person. And it's something I've always been involved in team events throughout my whole life with English 8-ball, captained the England team and all that stuff. So, yeah, I've had a lot of experience playing teams, and so that's why I sort of love it all.
But I guess give your YouTube channel, because you do a lot of drills, you do a lot of coaching on there as well. So why don't you give
that? Yeah, so that was the main reason for it, really. I mean, I really enjoy doing the drills. I was never a big drill person like 10, 15 years ago. Then about 5 years ago when I got my table in my house in America, that was like 2014, it was very hard to just practice on your own and just racking the balls up. So where before I always had someone to practice with, you know what I mean? So I was never a big drill person. But so about 2014, 15... once I got the table in my own house, I just thought, oh, I've got to start doing drills, like, otherwise I'll just get bored. So then I found them really interesting. It's really good for your concentration, your focus. It's good for everything, really, your pattern play, everything, cue ball control. So then I just started doing more and more. So I set up my YouTube channel around that time, around 2015, but didn't really get into it massively, really. I didn't really push it. And then, obviously, during this lockdown, I thought, well, now it's a great opportunity to really push it, get it out there, get it monetized and all that stuff, and which I did. I got someone to run it for me, Kinga Rauch from Poland. She lives in London. She's done an amazing job with the with the graphics. She doesn't ask for anything back in return. I just help her with her game. So I've become really good friends with her. So she's been a big help with the YouTube channel. But I just like putting content out there for people to learn from, or whether they criticise it or they whatever. I mean, it's just something I enjoy doing. I just like giving back to the game, because the game's been so good to me. So I like to give back to the people what really need it, and that's the amateurs and the fans. And so, yeah, I mean, even before all my issues in 2016, I was giving loads of stuff away. And I was doing a lot of stuff for charities. And I was sending people to the Moscone Cup by raising money for them to go. So, I mean, I just love helping people, I guess. I guess I'm a very generous person. Maybe a little bit too generous at times. But at the end of the day, the way I see it is that you can't take it with you. And so I like to give back to the game as much as I can, really. And so that's the main reason why I did the channel. And it's doing pretty well, actually, so I'm sort of happy with it. And people seem to enjoy it.
Yeah. And what's the name of it?
It's actually the Great White 76. So it's YouTube Great White 76. But I think if you just type in my name, you'll find it anyway. But the reason for Great White, because when I was in the Philippines in 2016 and 17, I was like the only white person there, really. And I'm playing all these money matches, and I was doing really well. So they nicknamed me the Great White. So, yeah, so I think I've had the YouTube channel over like 10 years, but just never really bothered with it. I just did like the odd stuff with it, but obviously now I've really got it looking a lot more professional, really.
Yep, cool. So we were discussing a little bit before this interview started, just chatting casually, and you brought up the idea of a potential players union and what that would actually mean to the players. Did you want to address that at all here?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've been going over this for 10, 15 years, well, since I've been in the game anyway. I mean, we have had a couple of times. Johnny Archer set up one, but, I mean, Johnny was, he got Dennis Walsh involved, but there was never really anything really transpired properly from it. Nobody was really, none of the players were really on board properly. It was more like for the American players, really. And then it's been spoke about, so that just crumbled. I don't know what happens to that, really. And then we were. Then it's been spoke about a few times. I think someone from Kamui, is it Darren Frank? He was on about doing something, but again, that never happened. And it's like the players are scared to speak or go against the promoters or the industry, really. And that's the problem: is that the players have no power. They can't speak for themselves. They're too scared to speak for themselves. And at the end of the day, we're all self-employed. We haven't signed any contracts with anybody, so you should be free to do whatever you want within reason. Because obviously, pools are very difficult living. There isn't many players making a living, so we have to play these tournaments or on online events to pay the bills. So I don't agree with a lot of stuff what's been going on lately, the politics of it, side of it, and stopping players and all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, we definitely need a players' union, but we need somebody to come in and do it properly, not a pool player. I think obviously someone like a Jim Telfer, really. I think he'd be pretty good at it. He's not frightened to speak his mind. He's a very educated guy, well respected with the players, very well liked. So even if it's someone like him, and just using him as an example, and then obviously we all like put some money into the pot, we get a proper setup, and we do it properly. Because without the players, there's no tournaments. And unfortunately, with pool, it isn't seen that way, which is very sad. But if you get 20, 30 of the top players in the world, all on the just not really putting demands out there, but having some rules for us, the players, what we would like in return to go and play in their tournaments and all that stuff. And like whether it's playing to a certain set of rules, getting the pocket sizes right, the added money, all that stuff. I mean, there should be a structure to the game. And that's the problem, is that there's no structure. So it's like I said before, we don't have a professional tour. Obviously, Matchroom's the closest thing to that, but still a long way off because they have three individual tournaments two open tournaments, let's say, where anyone can try and play in them, the US Open and the World Nine Ball, but the other three events are virtually impossible to get into them, unless you're a Jason Shaw or a Shane Van Bonin. So, yeah, I mean, we need more opportunities. We need a proper professional tour, more structure, a proper ranking system, and guidelines, and the players should be part of that. They should have a big say in all that, and sadly it hasn't happened. And I think going forward for the future of the game, that's definitely got to happen. Otherwise we just keep getting walked over and treated like kids, really.
All right, well said. And so I guess last week I had Johnny Archer on, and we got to hear a nice embarrassing story about you, Darren. We are going to give you the microphone back, and you can just light Johnny up. Let's hear it.
Oh, Johnny's unbelievable. I remember, like, obviously, before I come to American Pool, I thought, oh, Johnny Archer, used to watch him on TV all the time, and what a player he was. Unbelievable player. And I always thought he was a very boring poker face, no personality at all. I thought, this guy looks so miserable, it's unbelievable, when he played pool.
Or
he'd do interviews. I mean, this is when he was at his best, you know what I mean? Like, mid-2000s, what have you. Early 2000s, he was like probably the best player in the game at that time before I come on the scene. And then, so when I met him, I thought, oh, didn't reckon much to him. And then I played him, actually. I played him in a tournament around 2007. And I thought, oh, it'd be nice to beat him. And I actually beat him. And he was really nice to me. I thought he'd be really like pissed off, but he was really nice to me, complimenting my game, all that stuff. And then I sort of quickly found out he's got a good personality. He was really like very British mentality, really, like good sense of humour, everything else. So then every time I saw him after that, we just clicked. So we'd poke a lot of fun at each other.
And we've become pretty good friends, really. Like I said before, I don't really friend Hull players that much, but he'd definitely be up there in my top five or six. I always looked forward to seeing Johnny because you could make fun of him, and vice versa. So he'd take a lot of he'd give me like a lot of stick about the way I look and I'm ugly and everything else, and I'd do the same with him. So yeah, so we built up a relationship, played each other a load of times, everything else. So we played the bonus ball in Las Vegas. He was sort of a big part of that. So I got to know him really well then, and then we went on the road together in 2016 doing exhibitions, like the story what I think he's told. But Johnny's not really a drinker, where obviously I can be known to have a drink. So this one night we're doing the exhibition, and I said to Johnny, someone buy us some shots. He said, I have no shots, you know, like he speaks, I have no shots. He says, well, I've got to do exhibition. I says, Johnny, you can have one shot, aren't you? Says, no, I can't have no shot. I'll be drunk. I said, Johnny, you'll be all right with one shot, surely. So, like, we forced it on him, like. So he's had this one shot, and no word of a lie, within 10 minutes, he's like, legless. I couldn't believe it, and he can't make a ball. So I've had to end up doing the exhibition for him after that. But it was so funny because he was all over the place. But it was really funny. It was like, all like the room was really, it was a good crowd. Like, luckily it was a really good crowd, and they sort of enjoyed him like being drunk, really. And then afterwards we went to this bar, and he ended up having like about four or five shots. And I mean, he was absolutely gone. But it was so funny. Like, he's like falling over and stuff like that. And then he had this one shot in this bar. And I've gone to the restroom, I've come back, and he's just completely passed out. And that was Johnny Archer. I thought, Jesus, I thought, he's like a cheap date, he is. And then, like, the other thing is, like, when we're in the car, I don't know if you've seen the, when we was travelling in the car, he was doing the carpool karaoke. And
I've heard him sing, it ain't good.
It was just crazy. And he's into like Conway Twitty and Elvis Presley and everything else. And it was just so if there's people out there and they're on my page, I think if you look at my videos, you'll be able to see Johnny Archer singing. It's like something to behold.
Well, I'm gonna have to share this to the podcast page now. Times. Well, for the Cue It Up Cup, he tried to sing in what is it, John Denver.
Oh, yeah.
And that didn't go great.
He's a character. And another time, he was like, I think he lost a match. I can't remember where it was. It might have been in Chesapeake. He lost a match, and he was just sitting on this chair with his phone for about an hour. I was sort of like around the area, and he was really pissed off. Like, and then I've gone back to my room. I've come back to the venue maybe like an hour later, and he's still in the same position, with a phone in exactly the same position as it was before. He just sat there looking at his phone, didn't even blink or anything, with his legs crossed for about 2 or 3 hours. He just got beat. I just couldn't believe it. I've gone up to him. I said, Johnny, you all okay? He goes, yeah. So I thought, I better leave him. Like, so yeah. He's like an unbelievable character, really. His personality is unbelievable.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. He comes off as pretty quiet.
That's why I don't really judge people with first impressions anymore, because Johnny had definitely come into that category.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. He's a funny guy. He really has a huge personality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he's nuts, but in the best way possible.
Definitely the nuts part.
But I guess I am as well at times.
Yeah, we're pool players. I think we're all supposed to be, right?
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, Darren, it has been an absolute pleasure to get to chat with you today. I think this has been a pretty good interview, and I really appreciate you you joining me to talk with me.
Yeah, that's been all great. Thanks for having me on the show, and all the best with it going forward, and we'll see what we're going to do next. Seeing as though the Cue It Up Cup isn't going to go ahead, you have to think of something else.
I actually have an idea, and right. if I can't chat with you about it today, I'd really like to chat with you about it soon, because I think it's going to be a good one. But we'll close this out here, and thank you again for joining me one last time.
Okay, mate. Thanks a lot.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Queue It Up podcast.